Welcome to this episode of the Ghost Stories podcast, and what an interesting topic it's going to be with some extremely experienced and knowledgeable guests as well. So Vihan Ulifir and Mia Pieterse have joined me from Mazars, and we are going to be talking about fintech and digital assets. And these are the right people to do it because Vihan is the partner and head of fintech and digital assets at Mazars in South Africa. And Mia is also a partner at Mazars in South Africa in financial services with a focus on fintech. So this is going to be a pretty interesting conversation about how this stuff is making its way into corporates. I think this is not a conversation about what the Bitcoin price might do and whether or not you should be YOLOing all your money into Ethereum and what your Uber driver suggested you should buy last week. We all remember those days from the pandemic. So Vihan, Mia, thank you and welcome to the podcast. I'm very excited to learn from you guys because I don't know a hell of a lot about this world. So this is going to be an interesting one for me. Welcome. I think before we climb into any of the more detailed questions, Vihan, I'm going to start with you. Head of FinTech and Digital Assets is a pretty cool title. I'm going to ask you to start with what a digital asset is, because that could mean just about anything, right? So let's get an understanding of what this actually includes.
Yeah, thanks so much for having us on the podcast today. So a digital asset is essentially let's call it a digital representation of real world assets. So a lot of people would think that digital assets purely relates to, let's say, blockchain-based digital currencies, such as a Bitcoin, Ethereum, whatever the case may be. But digital assets has become so much more than that. If you look at specifically, let's say, a blockchain-based digital assets, it can be classified into various subdivisions, being, let's say, backed cryptocurrencies, unbacked cryptocurrencies, tokenized digital assets, and things like central bank digital currencies. So essentially, we're in a situation now where you can tokenize basically anything. And we saw that boom with what was happening in non-fungible tokens in that era. And people were creating non-fungible tokens relating to anything, even your grandmother's boots that she wore in 1920 walking across, I don't know which mountain. So they were tokenizing rhino horns a lot. But what was significant about this occurrence, and of course, a lot of people were tokenizing digital art and was pictures of monkeys that were selling for hundreds and thousands of dollars. But what was interesting is the development of the thought process of investors and how this can actually be used in other circumstances as well. So even though, and I always take this example of comparing NFTs to that of Lego. So even though it's fun to play when you're a kid, no one actually makes a living, or let's say maybe 0.001% of the general population out there makes a living playing Lego. But it was good to develop the mind in terms of understanding exactly how this works and how this can be utilized in real case scenarios. So we've also evolved into a space now where digital assets can relate to things that's been tokenized, such as property, real estate, such as tokenization of shares, units in funds. So there's a lot of elements that can be incorporated from a blockchain-based digital asset perspective when you look at a tokenization. But in essence, that is essentially what it is. We're moving into the realm of a digital economy, and therefore everything is becoming digital. Everything's housed on databases, on ledgers, on blockchains, the lot of it. And essentially, digital assets has become the new norm and will continue to do so. And essentially, you'll be probably in a situation a couple of years now where the listed exchanges don't use their, if we call it, historical back-end ledgers to record transactions being executed on a stock exchange. They might be using blockchain technology in the near future because of certain capabilities and functionalities the asset class or the technology rather has.
Yeah, very much putting the block in blockchain there, Vihan, and I love the Lego analogy. And if anyone does know how someone can make a living from Lego, then please do reach out and let me know how to do that, because I would truly, truly love to be able to do that. And we'll dig into some of those other concepts like backed versus unbacked crypto, you know, maybe later in the show. Mia, I want to swing it across to you because, you know, your description is more fintech than it is digital assets. And I'm keen to understand the differences between those things and what these things actually mean. So is fintech just a broader area than digital assets? I would imagine so. And whenever anyone says fintech to me, I always think payment solutions and all that kind of stuff as well.
So fintech effectively is a combination of financial technology, and it really refers to like an app or software or technology that you use that you can digitally access to manage your own finances. And that's done in a variety of ways. So either your own finances or to make financial transactions. I think the one that we all know and can really relate to is mobile money, because we all have mobile phones and you can easily just log onto your online banking platform, do a transaction, trade, whatever you need to do. So it's really, really the purpose of fintech is to move away from the traditional way of doing your finances, managing your finances. I'm speaking from an investor perspective now, and not just go to a brick and mortar type bank, but rather you being in charge as an investor of your own finances. I think traditionally what you'll do, you'll go to a bank, physical bank, you'll go in, you'll transact, whereas now there's really some smart players in the market or early adopters, if you can call them that, to really partner with those traditional banks to advance them and speed them up to where they should be from a technology perspective. Because I think that's the biggest challenge. They didn't stay up to date in terms of technology infrastructure perspective. So it was really difficult for them to keep up with the times and meet investor needs. So there's really a lot of players that partner with traditional banks or some clever players in the market that created some good technology to service their clients. But it's really giving the power back to investors to put them in charge of their own financial transactions and making their own decisions.
Yeah, it's super interesting. We've seen tons of activity in this space, right? I mean, MTN has done kind of a separate deal in its fintech business with one of the big credit card companies. We've seen tons and tons of venture capital money flowing to fintech over the years. I actually attended a very interesting conference last week. Okay, admittedly, it was held by climate tech type investors, but they actually highlighted that, you know, for years, fintech got the lion's share of venture capital money. These days, it's more of a one-to-one relationship with climate tech, which tells you as much about climate tech as I think it does about fintech. I think it's the old story where a lot of different fintech models were kind of introduced and people were hoping that they could disrupt big portions of the banking value system. Some of that maybe has worked. You know, I think the mobile money, smartphone kind of stuff makes a lot of sense. Some of it I think has not necessarily worked. You know, on the payment side, some of these things are solutions desperately looking for a problem, I think. So it becomes quite difficult to actually, you know, carve out a business in this space, especially in something like payments. I'm personally a shareholder in Visa and MasterCard because at the end of the day, they are the backbone of all of it, right? And I kind of think that no matter how cute a fintech solution is, unless it's kind of an e-wallet to e-wallet that doesn't touch a bank account or another merchant, it's probably going to touch either Visa or MasterCard. So it's quite interesting to see these solutions coming in, and especially in emerging markets. I think fintech is particularly interesting. I mean, another thing we've seen is buy now, pay later. We covered Affirm on Magic Markets recently. That's one of the big US buy now, pay laters. Home Choice released results in South Africa recently. They own a local buy now, pay later, BNPL kind of business. So there's just a lot going on in the space, in the broader sort of fintech environment. And it's actually it's quite different to digital assets at the end of the day, right? Because digital assets talks to the technology around blockchain and these coins. So I guess, Vian, I'm going to kick it back to you and say, you know, what are you seeing among corporates in terms of adoption of this kind of blockchain technology? I mean, you referenced the Bored Apes earlier, which was such a pandemic thing, right? People paying an absolute fortune for literally a digital picture of a very nicely cool drawn kind of funky monkey, for want of a better description, literally. I mean, that's one of the best ways to see what happened in the pandemic. I don't think corporates are doing too much of that. But what are you seeing in terms of blockchain opportunities and adoption? Because that obviously talks to Mazars' involvement as well, you know, and what you guys actually do in this space.
Yeah, so we've seen a variety of instances where the technology has been utilized for various types of things. I think you always look and try to find the killer application. Where's the area that something like a technology such as blockchain technology is expected to make the most significant impact at the end of the day? And I mean, we've looked at multiple use cases. You've seen instances where certain information can be put on the blockchain, and then it basically it's a part of this idea of self-sovereignty where you are in control and possession of your own information, your own identity, and you move forward from there. But from a perspective of utilizing technology, and one needs to focus on what is it you're looking to achieve here. And maybe to put it into context, if you look like something like a commercial banks usually have what we refer to as nodes. So it's basically copies of ledgers. So commercial banks usually have, let's say, around 8 nodes. So it's 8 nodes transacting and reconciling on a second-by-second basis within the bank itself. But once again, it's a centralized function. Now, of course, people have also used blockchain technology as almost a buzzword, where they want to incorporate blockchain technology, but they want to do it for the wrong reasons as well. So at the end of the day, you set up a system or ledger or whatever process you're looking to incorporate using the technology, and you defeat the purpose of of its ability to be decentralized, and you make it a centralized ledger. So there's no point in having it. Blockchain technology was specifically devised to facilitate peer-to-peer transactions without the need for an intermediary, and of course do it with the use of distributed ledger technology. Of course, it uses other elements such as cryptography and consensus mechanism. But the key thing there was it was created to be decentralized. There shouldn't be any intermediary there. So of course, there is a lot of functionality that can use on the layer one application, let's say, of the blockchain or Bitcoin blockchain or Ethereum blockchain itself that you can use for various purposes. But of course, people start to build second layer applications on top of that first layer application. And that's where the real use case comes in, whether it is with transferring information or transferring various types of assets or transferring currencies. There's is really a host of various functionalities that you can facilitate using the technology. To give you an example, so one of the killer applications in my point of view is the movement of funds, because essentially the technology allows for the movement of data or the movement of funds the same way that information moves over the internet. It can do so freely and can do so quickly as well. So where you can use the technology is to facilitate cross-border payments and remittances. And I mean, with South Africa and Africa's large migrant workforce, this is definitely a big need out there. So to give you an example, someone currently working somewhere in Malawi and sending back money to South Africa, or most probably it's the other way around, let's say $100 is being generated in a day. And usually $5 or something as large as $20 away can be paid on transaction fees alone. And essentially, the technology with something like blockchain technology, the idea is, and even with mobile money, even with fintech in general, the idea is to remove that friction at the end of the day that causes the money to land up into the pocket of the individuals or the families sending the money. And I think that's the real killer application. And technology, be it fintech or blockchain technology, is able to do that in seconds. So give an example. So I did my secondment in the New York office way back when in 2015, 2016. And when I had to transact and move funds that I've earned in the US back to South Africa, I did that to normal wire transfers, essentially. So it took about 2 to 3 days, and I mean, it was costly as well. If I remember correctly, it was about 1,200 Rand altogether. But you can execute that same transaction with the use of technology, such as blockchain technology, that same transaction can be executed in a question of a couple of seconds, anything between 1 and 3 seconds. And the cost involved with that will be $0.00001. So that's the efficiencies that we're trying to look for when looking at the technology. But I mean, back to your question, there is a variety of use cases that we've seen. Of course, digital currencies is not the beginning and the ending of digital assets, blockchain technology, and fintech altogether. There's so many other applications that can be utilized. We've seen banks also look at various ways to incorporate assets. I mean, we were looking at Project COCA as well, where they were looking at interbank settlements between the various banks as well, utilizing that instead of SWIFT. So there is definitely a lot of use cases. But from my point of view, it will definitely be with the cross-border payments, remittances, interbank settlements, those types of things where the killer application of the technology will sit.
Yeah, so basically a direct attempt to disrupt my Visa and MasterCard shareholding, which is obviously something I've thought of as part of owning those shares, right? And you know, Visa and MasterCard have commented on it along the way as well. I kind of back them to find a way to be involved in whatever really happens in this sort of blockchain space. They're too big and important and clever and wealthy not to. But absolutely anything that sort of removes a lot of those friction costs, that makes a lot of sense. I do want to ask you one more question, Vian, before we move back to Mia. So just in terms of the proliferation of coins, you know, for someone who kind of just looks at this crypto world from the outside looking in and understands that underneath all of this, yes, there is some kind of interesting technology, you know, which may well play a role going forward in cross-border remittances, et cetera. But then they see, you know, millions of ridiculous coins and pictures of dogs and Elon Musk and everything else that comes with it. I mean, there's kind of this world beyond, I suppose, Bitcoin and Ethereum, and I must confess, I'm no crypto expert whatsoever. You know, those are sort of your big two, and then there's a whole lot of stuff. There's a very long tail. Is that all just noise as part of the broader trend underlying all of this? You know, just to help people understand, should they still be taking blockchain seriously despite some of this stuff?
Yeah, so I absolutely love that question. What is going on in the digital asset space in terms of the coins and the currencies and all those things? Even if you look at the IPOs, I'm not sure if you watched that recent documentary on Netflix, that BitCon as well. I think something like 75 or 78% of the ICOs that occurred during a certain period was all scams, because it was just a big hype and no one actually understood what was going on. And the same applies to the coins as well. I mean, there's a lot of coins that has no intrinsic value. So to give them an example, so we spoke about layer one, layer two previously. So Bitcoin essentially is a layer one blockchain. And the same applies to Ethereum. It's a layer one blockchain. But Ethereum, for example, has a functionality where you can create coins on top of the Ethereum blockchain, which you refer to as ERC-20 tokens. And the ERC-20 comes from the standards being introduced and, of course, the functionality of the layer one application allowing you to create secondary tokens on this layer one application. So if you look at some of the tokens currently in circulation, a lot of them are ERC-20 tokens. So it's a token that someone just made up, created a limited supply of it, and it piggybacks off the native of, let's say, the layer one application, which is the Ethereum blockchain. So there's no real value add in terms of that specific token. Bitcoin, for example, it has certain functionalities. It addresses the blockchain trilemma quite nicely as well. That is that element of it's completely decentralized. Of course, there is an issue with the scalability, but of course, you have the Bitcoin Lightning Network sitting parallel to that, that addresses that scalability issue. Ethereum as well, it's a fantastic protocol to work on. I mean, there's a lot of functionality on it. It enables smart contracts as well. And it can enable a lot of things going forward, as well as the creation of other second layer applications. But back to your question in terms of the tokens and what you need to look out for. So usually when you look at these tokens, you need to look at the underlying technology. Does it actually add any value? Is it just 2 million, trillion, billion dog coins that's been created that has no intrinsic value? It's just basically a thing that's being chased because of there's an element of scarcity built into it. There's a hype being created around it, all those sorts of things. So when people do look at blockchain-based digital assets as a whole, they need to understand that there's technology associated with it. And you need to think about what problem is it actually solving. You need to think, is it addressing the blockchain trilemma? You need to think about the fact that can it be used in real-world scenarios as well. So from that perspective, there is a lot to consider. You can't only just look at the meme coins. I think there's something like 10,000 coins currently in circulation, but in the long run, that will expect to die down. I mean, the cryptocurrency market as a whole is, let's say, it's almost a bit older than a decade. So there's still a lot of time for that weeding out to take place. But of course, it's a lot more difficult rather because of the fact that it's completely decentralized and it's not regulated by a specific country or jurisdiction.
Yeah, it's mega interesting, right? I mean, this early days stuff, I think people just bought a lot of coins for the sheer option value. Now, I don't know where this thing's going, but if I put $100 into, 100 different coins, then who knows? And irritating, some people made a lot of money like that. And I say irritatingly for like my traditional investment and finance brain, I mean, it's literally gambling and that's fine. I think as long as people understand what it is, it's when they start talking about how, Warren Buffett doesn't know what he's doing because they made money on a coin named after some odd animal or worse, then it starts to get a bit dangerous. But that's how markets work, right? Lots of hype, bubbles pop. A portion of what was in that bubble stays behind and grows and gets into the next phase of its growth. So it's that weeding out process. I fully agree. That is basically what it is every step of the way. And that's not unique to blockchain and digital assets. I mean, it happens in the listed market as well all the time. So it is interesting to see human nature is human nature. Behavioral finance is what it is. And it plays out in markets, right? They're nothing more than just people coming together to buy and sell things. So why wouldn't it play out there? I think, Mia, back to you on the fintech side, a lot of this is around helping people just move money around, right? I mean, financial services wise, that is at the end of the day what we need to do. There's other stuff as well in there, right? Like insurtech and all those sort of additional products that kind of come in there. What I wanted to ask you is, are you seeing much in the way of activity still into Africa from South Africans doing stuff? Or is a lot of that happening in country, to your knowledge, money flowing into those countries? And the reason I ask is because obviously for fintech to really do well, you just need people transacting more and more and more. And if a lot of those people are relatively unbanked, then fintech is more powerful, right? Which is why mobile money has done what it's done in Africa, because the thesis is, well, you're more likely to have a smartphone in your pocket than you are to potentially have a formal bank account. So just any commentary around, I suppose, those trends, how Africa's being serviced from South Africa, that kind of thing.
I think maybe just on the first question, I think every single person today or most people today has a mobile phone, and it doesn't even have to be a smartphone to enable you to actually transact. It can really be, for example, if you look at something like M-Pesa, I'm not sure if you're familiar with M-Pesa, but that's a great example of what work extremely well in a country like Kenya, where you can send money with via SMS through just, I take your number, send you cash, you have it, and I don't even have to be connected to the internet. And that same example, for example, M-Pesa didn't get mass adoption in South Africa and it didn't work well for a variety of reasons. So I think to answer your question, I think there's different ways of making use of mobile money. It works in different countries for different reasons. But at the end of the day, the main thing that you have to focus on is obviously the users need to understand why they're making use of the specific application or like, for example, M-Pesa, like I mentioned earlier, or they need to understand what they're doing and they want the power in their own hands to manage their finances. And the second thing is mass adoption. In Kenya, that worked well because, I mean, they're also a country that has a huge unbanked population and they had to find alternative ways of transacting and trading. And from the merchants, the individuals, investors, I mean, they don't even use it for investor purposes. It's just for daily barter and to trade. So, I mean, we've all been trading since 1,000 years ago and we're effectively doing it today the same way we did it back then. We're moving back to cutting out the middleman by making use of fintech. So I think that's an important principle to just remember. I think also just the second part of your question, there's been a lot of activity in South Africa in terms of fintech in a variety of sectors, if I can call it that. And a lot of it has worked really well, but a lot of it hasn't worked well. You'll also see if you go onto your payment profile or do some online shopping, you might have seen a couple of years ago or months ago, you would have been able to pay with a certain merchant, but now you can't do that anymore. It's just, I think it's being tried and tested by a variety of suppliers. So, but then that same principle or same application method doesn't work well in other countries. What we have seen, and I mean, Vian and I also did wrote a co-piece on fintech a couple of weeks back that was published, is there's a lot of entrants coming in through South Africa, particularly coming in fintech players and then entering the market, doing really well, and then moving into other countries with similar characteristics, if I can call it that, to South Africa. So, for example, like also emerging markets like Kenya, Nigeria, Botswana, because they have similar challenges to what we have. And I don't want to say it's a copy and paste exercise from what's happening in the South Africa market, but you can basically tweak that same business model slightly for a Botswana or a Nigeria and get the same benefits.
Yeah, that does make a lot of sense. So I think as we look to bring the podcast to a close, Vian, I'm going to bring this one back to you now. Just Mazars' involvement in this broader fintech space, there's a lot going on here. It is all very interesting and exciting. You know, what do you guys do with your clients? Is it only on the audit side? Is there an advisory piece to it as well? It'd be good to understand that world on your side.
Sure. So we usually differentiate within the firm between what we refer to as Channel 1 and Channel 2 services. And Channel 1 services, of course, being assurance, and Channel 2 service being anything else but assurance. But in terms of servicing the clients, we have expertise within Mazars South Africa. So me and myself have specialized in various sectors and we have dealt with clients. We're attending seminars, we're writing pieces, we're doing our research to make sure that we acquire the relevant knowledge to be able to assist clients operating in the fintech space. So from an assurance point of view, yes, we do service clients in the assurance space as well, based on our expertise and experience in the market as well. Of course, Mia and myself have a background from a financial services perspective. Of course, Mia being also more involved with illicit entities. But that essentially evolved into the area of fintech. As soon as you understand financial services, fintech to understand comes very naturally. So from that perspective as well, we've also serviced a variety of clients outside of just assurance work. So we do a lot of consulting, in terms of, let's say, tax consulting, corporate restructurings to make sure that the structures put in place is tax efficient and, of course, doesn't cause any issues from a tax point of view. Specifically with the, as you mentioned, with the fintech areas, because usually South Africa is seen as an entry point into the bigger African market. And, of course, international participants in the fintech market usually also approach Africa first through South Africa. And, of course, from South Africa's standpoint, they integrate further into Africa. And, of course, that has a necessity to set up these types of corporate structures. I mean, we've been involved with various areas, including sustainability, for example. Sustainability and ESG is a hot topic currently, and everyone wants to make sure they're doing the right thing in terms of that. We've assisted with internal audit engagements. We've assisted with fraud investigations involving fintech type of businesses. So we do cover a variety of these, let's call it subsectors in the fintech, as a result of the experience we've gathered over the last couple of years. And of course, me and myself assist these various teams, be it, let's say, from a corporate finance perspective, from a tax perspective, from a sustainability perspective, all the way to fraud investigations. We assist these teams based on our expertise, and we've got a good working knowledge of the various industries that we operate in. So it becomes very, very easy to assist these teams to be able to add value to the client, to service clients, based on their specific needs as well.
Bien, Mia, I think let's leave it there. Thank you so much for your time on the show and just sort of putting the spotlight on this exciting world. It's something that corporates really can't ignore, not just corporates, but also smaller businesses are going to start to be more and more impacted by this. The venture capital comes years before the widespread adoption. I mean, that's the way this game works, you know, and it's easy to assume that widespread change won't happen. All you need to look at is Microsoft's business over the past 10 years and how that has evolved completely and what that has done for my Microsoft shares, which I'm very happy to be a proud owner of. So Vian, Mia, thank you so much for your time. And I would imagine both of you are on LinkedIn and are contactable for those who want to connect with you. That's Vihan Ulifir and Mia Pieterse. Thank you so much, guys. And I look forward to doing another one of these with you at some point, and we can see how that adoption journey is going.
Thank you very much for having us.
Perfect. Thanks so much for the time.